This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, the Bush administration announced plans to withdraw American troops from their positions along the demilitarized zone that separates North and South Korea. For half a century now, they've stood ready on that volatile frontier as a tripwire and a deterrent. All sides knew that an attack from the North would have to involve U.S. troops in the first minutes and bring America into any new Korean War. Tensions on the peninsula have increased since North Korea disclosed an active nuclear weapons program last fall. Over the weekend, the official North Korean news agency issued its clearest public acknowledgement to date, and while the rhetoric remains hostile, U.S. officials say they expect Pyongyang to agree to multilateral talks on the nuclear issue within a couple of months. So why reposition U.S. forces now? Is the plan designed to reduce tensions, or, as some say, does moving American troops off the front line make an American military option more thinkable? And how does this move fit into the Bush administration's plans to transform the American military and its web of bases around the world? Later this hour, we'll speak with sports writer John Feinstein about his new book, Open, Inside the Ropes at Bethpage Black, and we'll find out why the forecast for your local weather forecast is sunnier. But first, we'll explore what changes in American military deployments mean for international relations and national security. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN@npr.org. Joining us now is Joel Witt. He served at the State Department coordinating the North Korea Agreed Framework for Nuclear Nonproliferation under President Clinton. He's currently a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he joins us by phone from his office here in Washington. It's good to have you back on the program.
Happy to be here.
Over the weekend, the North Korean government, as we mentioned, issued its clearest statement to date that it's working on nuclear weapons. Privately, it's acknowledged that it has nuclear weapons. What's the linkage between the announced plan on conventional forces, the plan to pull American forces further south into Korea, and the nuclear program of North Korea?
Well, I think there are two separate developments, although it's very interesting because in the statement you're talking about, the North Korean statement, which I guess was yesterday, they also said that they were building nuclear weapons because they wanted to cut back on their conventional forces.
Transform the North Korean military.
They want to transform their military, and you know, if one took that at face value, you might think it was a positive sign, and maybe there's some room for some sort of arms control agreement in the future that would lessen the numbers of conventional forces on both sides. But you know, I wouldn't take it that far yet. But the point here is these two developments, I think, are taking place separately. There's not really a linkage between the U.S. moves and the North Korean nuclear program, although in the past, quite honestly, the U.S. has stopped plans for changing its conventional force posture when the North Korean nuclear threat seemed greatest.
Well, what is the thinking then behind the idea of pulling U.S. forces further south? As we mentioned, for half a century now, they've stood there as a tripwire to deter a possible North Korean attack.
Well, I think that the Pentagon has been thinking some time about changing the deployment of this force in Korea and pulling it back. And there is a very strong military rationale for doing that, namely that, you know, the American troops where they are now are basically targets for North Korean artillery. If you pull them back south many miles, they are no longer targets. And on top of that, it makes it easier for the U.S. forces to strike back at the North Koreans using new technologies that we have nowadays that allow us to attack targets at greater ranges. So militarily, I think it makes a lot of sense. The problem is that it's been handled very badly politically, and it has triggered concerns, certainly in South Korea, that this is some sort of punishment for South Korea's, or what's perceived as South Korea's anti-American sentiment.
There has also been suspicion voiced that this is a move that would make U.S. military options more thinkable if the United States acted at this moment to try to decapitate North Korea's political leadership or take out its nuclear weapons program facilities. The response would be directed at American troops who are right there on the DMZ. If they're further south, that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, I understand that concern, and I wouldn't overplay it, though. At least from my perspective, any military action on the Korean Peninsula, no matter where U.S. troops are located, is going to be devastating, and there are going to be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people killed. So the fact that 37,000 American troops aren't hit in the initial action doesn't mean that it's more thinkable. I think it's still very difficult to contemplate.
Well, you mentioned the political reaction in South Korea. What is their perception at this moment? Do they think they're being punished, or couldn't this have been negotiated in advance?
Well, the problem is, first of all, this is an evolving perception, so I don't want to make that sound like it's written in stone. But, you know, I was in South Korea a month ago before the recent progress in agreeing to this pullback, and there was a perception that either they were being punished or that there was some hidden agenda here. And it's hard to understand, but the South Koreans have difficulty reading what's really going on in Washington, so they see a lot of neoconservatives arguing for the withdrawal, the total withdrawal of U.S. forces from Korea. And so they see this plan as maybe the first step in that process, and it makes them very nervous.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. And John joins us on the line from San Antonio, Texas.
Hey, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The comment I just had to make was, I'm a service member. I was in Korea from 1992 to 94. And my experience is, first of all, the North Koreans are experts at negotiating from a point of weakness. If we look back over the last couple of years, and I'm not even really that old, but I remember so many instances where they'll use information to their advantage to say, we have nuclear weapons, we don't have nuclear weapons, and then say, now how would you like to help us? And then the second point is the redeployment of forces from the north has been something that was heavily talked about even when I was there back in 92. If you'll remember, about that time, we gave back a large portion of our main base inside of Seoul that had been used as a golf course. We gave it back to the South Koreans to use as a park, and that really helped our community standing because instead of, you know, us taking up this huge area right along the Han River, we gave it back to them. And they really enjoyed it.
Joel Witt, part of the current plan is to leave the rest of that base, indeed, in Seoul.
Yeah, and as your caller said, this is something that has been gradually in the works for some time. And another program that's in the works is trying to consolidate all the U.S. bases that are located around South Korea. And one of the reasons is we're being very sensitive to the South Korean concerns about the American presence and about generating anti-American sentiment. So, you know, this is not something that it just happened overnight. On the other hand, I think the timing of the U.S. move has made the South Koreans suspicious, and also the fact that, Secretary Rumsfeld announced this in late last year, at a time where also the Pentagon was making very negative statements about the anti-American sentiment in South Korea. So that was very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about John's first point about, you probably more familiar with this, having negotiated with North Koreans about their ability to negotiate from a position of weakness than most people?
Well, sure. The North Koreans are very good at that because they've been very weak for a number of years. And it's very hard to negotiate if you admit you're a weak country. So, of course, the North Koreans are very good at negotiating from a situation of weakness. On the other hand, of course, I would disagree with people who think that they've gotten the better of us. And I would just argue that if you look at North Korea in 1992, before the 94 agreement, and you look at the situation in their country today, there's no one who will argue that North Korea is much better off today than it was in 1992. It's a much weaker state. Its economy has continued to go downhill. And so, you know, I would argue the North Koreans really haven't done very well.
John, that's an excellent point, and that is sort of the main idea we need to keep in our heads, that the North Korean people really are doing worse every day, and yet I hate to use the term regime, but Kim Jong-il stays within his bubble of happiness. And really, that is what drives all of North Korea's moves, is Kim Jong-il maintaining his happy world around him. And, you know, there's a saying that in any weak country, the Shah eventually falls. I think, you know, Kim Jong-il, when he's negotiating, is doing what he can to stay in power the longest. And so I don't think he'll actually take any aggressive moves like invading the South or blowing a nuke over Japan, because he knows now that that will result in his removal from power by any means necessary.
John, it's been a while since you've been there. What would you think, though, would be the reaction of U.S. troops in Korea to this proposed move?
The folks up in the Second ID are probably going to be happy. It's not exactly a garden spot of Korea. I was stationed at Camp Humphreys with the 43rd MASH, actually the last MASH unit on active duty in that area, and we enjoyed it because we were down off the border. We weren't, as they say, right under the gun. We knew that we were going to have about 15 minutes of warning for anything that would happen, whereas the guys up in the Second ID had bunkers outside of their barracks, and we did rotations up there and got into the mindset, and it's not a happy way to live.
Well, John, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Bye.
And Joel Witt, we appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
Joel Witt, a senior fellow of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was with us from his office here in Washington. And with us on the line now is Ashton Carter. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Clinton, the current co-director of Harvard University's Preventive Defense Project. And he's with us by phone from his office on the campus there. Good of you to be with us.
Good to be here.
What do you think about this change in U.S. troop deployments along the Korean Peninsula? How does it fit into the administration's larger plan for military transformation?
Well, unfortunately, the transformation idea doesn't particularly apply so well on the Korean Peninsula. I mean, after all, we're not talking about, as we are in Europe, about moving troops hundreds of kilometers from Germany to Central Asia. We're talking about just a few tens of kilometers south. These are redeployments that we considered in the 1990s. We also considered perfectly reasonable things to do, but not worth paying a big price in misperception for. And I think the way we're doing this now in the Korean Peninsula does risk major misperception.
In the South or in the North?
Well, both. In the South, it sounds to them, rightly or wrongly, like less commitment to their defense. They asked for us to delay this. They asked for us to talk about it more, and we pushed forward. And that, to South Koreans, makes it look like we don't care what they think, and that we're in fact seeking freedom of action on the peninsula, free from them. North Korea is also a problem. If North Korea perceives this as a lessened American commitment, We all know what that means. That lowers deterrence on the peninsula, makes more and more likely. You all have to remember that the South Koreans are capable of defending themselves. It's been many years since South Korea needed, in a physical sense, military sense, our presence there. The reason we're there shoulder to shoulder with the South Koreans is that our being there makes it even plainer to North Korea that they can't win, and hopefully therefore deters them. And also, if God forbid a war does begin on the Korean Peninsula, it'll be over faster and with less bloodshed because we're there. That's where we're there, not because the South can't win.
Now, we'll have to go to North Korean misperceptions after we come back from a break. So hold that thought, and we'll rejoin you after a short break. We're talking about changes in American military strategy on the Korean Peninsula and around the world. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing changes in the arrangements of American military forces around the world. You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. Our current guest is Ashton Carter, co-director of Harvard's Preventative Defense Project. He's on the phone with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Before the break, we were talking about the plan to reposition U.S. forces in South Korea to pull them farther south, off the front lines there. You were speaking just before the break of the possible misperceptions of that move in South Korea. Now, what about the North?
Well, North could take it two ways. One is that we are lowering our defense commitment to South Korea. And from the North's eyes, that may embolden them to take steps that they wouldn't take if we were shoulder to shoulder with the South Koreans. That weakens deterrence and makes war more likely. On the other hand, and that would be bad, of course, on the other hand, North Korea might also interpret this as us positioning ourselves to be able to attack them, that is, to strike, for example, at their nuclear facilities at Yongbyon, and then say to them in the aftermath of such a strike, listen, there's no point in your attacking southward. To the south of you, you'll only run into your countrymen. South Koreans, they didn't have anything to do with this attack. We did it. Therefore, there's no point in making that attack. To the extent that positions us better to strike at their nuclear facilities, something we contemplated, by the way, in 1994 when I was in office, that positions us better in the nuclear crisis. And that makes theoretical sense, and many in the administration are saying so. What doesn't make any sense about that argument is that this repositioning won't take place for years. And the North Korean nuclear crisis is now. So this is irrelevant to solving the North Korean nuclear crisis. And therefore, you really have to wonder why we're doing it now and why we're risking all of this misperception.
Let's go now to the broader issue of U.S. deployments around the world and the shifts there. Obviously, there's a plan, a more immediate plan, to pull U.S. forces, or at least the great majority of them, out of Saudi Arabia and to transform the American military to make it lighter and more able to respond to crises in many other parts of the world. Obviously, Korea is probably one example where if there's one place where Cold War ideas might be justified, that would be the place. But Ash Carter, there's a lot of places around the world where things are changing and ideas that used to be sort of set in stone are now being more flexible.
Right. The redeployment makes a lot more sense elsewhere than the Korean Peninsula. That's particularly true in Europe, where we still have the basing structure appropriate to defense of West Germany against East Germany, a problem that is happily 15 years behind us. And also in the Middle East, where our presence in Saudi Arabia was a problem that in part, at least according to what he says, inspired Osama bin Laden. Militarily, in terms of how we fight, we don't require huge formations anymore. We operate in smaller formations. Agility, speed, and operating in small units is our style, our unique style in waging war, and it may therefore make sense for our basing structure to match that. I do have one concern I think people ought to bear in mind when they think about basing, though. It's not purely a military matter. There are two other things going on here. One is how you base U.S. forces, the preeminent military power in the world's forces, says everything to the rest of the world about your commitments, who your friends are, who you're annoyed with, and we need to be sensitive to those signals we send. And secondly, I think our military is immeasurably improved by being based overseas. When we went into Bosnia, for example, in 1995, I remember it well, when we went into Afghanistan a couple of years ago and now Iraq, our soldiers are better than other soldiers around the world, not only in their military proficiency, but in their ability to handle sensitive political situations. And in part, that's because all of our officers and many of our soldiers have lived in foreign countries. And you have to wonder how good we would be at that if if they'd never been outside of Oklahoma or Massachusetts or California.
Joining us now is Tom Donnelly. He's a defense policy analyst with the American Enterprise Institute. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
If the military transformation proceeds according to Secretary Rumsfeld's ideas, how do you think American troop deployments are going to look like? What do you think it's going to be changed to in 5 or 10 years?
Well, one of the earlier guests sort of made the comment about what the art of the possible is and the fact that this will take a long time, even if it proceeds with all deliberate speed. So in 5 or 10 years even, things will look sort of what they look like now.
Yet we have forces in Central Asia now that were almost impossible to imagine
five or ten years ago. It's easier to acquire than it is to disinvest, if I can mix my metaphors a bit, as we see in Korea. And certainly, if we do realign our posture in Europe, the political storm that comes out of that will be easily as great as the questions that arise out of Korea. Mm-hmm. Also, we should keep in mind that we have looming in the background a further round of U.S. base closures and realignment.
Always popular
excruciating
in Congress.
process is going to start up again in a couple of years. So there'll be a lot of moving pieces and a lot of political China that gets broken in that process, too.
Ash Carter, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you the same question. Obviously, Tom Donnelly, spoke about the political risks involved here. And as we talk about this idea of transformation, he's absolutely right. No matter how much you transform the U.S. Army, it's not going to ever be a lightning fast transformation.
Well, that's true. At the same time, I think that we do plan to be out of Saudi Arabia very soon. And that is a major political development in the Middle East. You mentioned the bases of Central Asia. I think they're there to stay. You're not right that this couldn't have been imagined a few years ago. I was involved in setting up those relationships 10 years ago, and we did envision the possibility that we might want to use bases in that region. At that time, didn't foresee exactly who the opponent would be. So this is something that does evolve slowly, but some of these changes are very dramatic. What's happening in Saudi Arabia, very dramatic. What's happening in Korea, even though it'll take years, is a thunderclap in South Korean and possibly North Korean politics. And even in Germany, I think that the Europeans are looking at this and asking themselves, what does it all mean other than military logic? So even if the repositioning takes some time, the political repercussions are now.
Ashton Carter, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Ashton Carter is co-director of the Preventative Defense Project at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He was with us on the line from his office up there in Cambridge. And let's get a phone call in. Next on the line is Joe, who's on the line with us from Miami, Florida.
Yes, hello, Neil.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call yet again.
Sure.
The reason for my call is having a date with my children today as I was driving up and I heard this conversation. It's I'm very germane to the conversation in that I've lived in Korea, I've lived in Germany, and I've lived in Italy.
Sounds like you must have been in the military.
A soldier.
Yes, I was active duty fighter pilot. Now I'm in the Air Force Reserves, still flying. My friends and I were discussing things along these lines fairly recently, and the conclusion we came to is that while it is very nice to live in Germany and live in Italy, maybe it's time to forward deploy a little bit more and move into the countries that are closer to the areas of the world where we perceive involvement.
For instance?
Specifically Eastern Europe.
Yeah, Eastern Europe as opposed to the current bases that are largely clustered in Germany.
Yes. The fold-a-gap scenario obviously is no more.
The fold-a-gap, the spot on the what used to be the inner German border between East and West Germany where it was thought Soviet tanks would rumble into Western Europe.
Correct.
One of the things, Joe, that they're talking about in moving these bases, though, is to make them a little bit more Spartan than the facilities that have been built up over decades in Western Europe. It would be more difficult for people to bring along their families, for one thing.
That is part of the biggest problem, is if you want a forward-deployed rapid force, it has to be unencumbered. And in the reserves, we feel that very often we're sent to deploy, and we leave behind our family and friends. In the Air Force, right now, we have the AEF cycle, the Air Expeditionary Forces, which are used on a rotating basis so as to find a compromise between quality of life when you're at home and the sustained combat capability for the theater force commanders.
Well, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, look, the caller raises a number of really important and interrelated issues. First of all, it's been pretty obvious to folks in service that something like this was essential because they have been operating in different places and in different ways for the past decade. So this has been the reality, and it's overdue to adjust the more permanent structure to account for this. What does make me nervous a little bit is these quality of life issues. Part of the contract, if you will, between America and the people who serve in uniform is that they can maintain some semblance of a family life and do professional service at the same time. I'm also willing to bet that our pilot friend at some point over the past couple of years spent a couple of weeks in the Saudi desert, if he's either a F-16 pilot or a refueling tanker pilot. And whether you can do that on a larger scale and do this sort of expeditionary style of operations on a larger scale when, say, you're a foot soldier and you're trying to pacify Iraq or Afghanistan, and it takes you 2 weeks to figure out who's on first and 6 months to figure out who the local bad guys are, I think is a less certain proposition.
Joe, it sounds like you've got some immediate priorities there in the car with you.
Well, actually, no, we're out of the car. We're standing in line to go see Finding Nemo. I took an afternoon with my children. Well, I enjoyed the conversation, and I very much thank you for taking my call.
Well, according to all the reviews, you should enjoy the picture, too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Good day.
Tom Donnelly, one of the things he mentioned, though, was an interesting concept that we've overlooked, and that was the Air Expeditionary Force. This is a reorganization of the Air Force that, again, 10, 15 years ago was entirely new and is now accepted part. I mean, it used to be there were fighter squadrons and bomber squadrons and refueling squadrons, and now these are all mixed together into units that can be deployed as a unit overseas and can do a whole number of different things.
Well, the process is actually still
under
development. Halfway over the fence. It's like a horse halfway over the fence. And the problem being, I mean, it's essential for these kinds of operations because we don't really fight in massive fleets. We don't have the swarm of Soviet fighters. Like, we don't have the hordes of Soviet tanks that we have to worry about. But as the Air Force has kind of announced, assembling that large force, as we did for the Iraq War, is putting a pretty big hiccup into the AEF cycle, and it's going to take them 6 months, I think, or more to sort of get back in that normal rotational cycle of things. And this is the sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't dilemma that we're going to be in. And we ought to be careful about our ability to assemble a big force on those hopefully rare occasions when we need it without sort of breaking the whole structure.
We're speaking about the change in U.S. military deployments, not only in South Korea, as proposed, but around the world. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a call now from Justin, and Justin's on the line from South Bend, Indiana.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
All right.
Thanks for taking my call. Okay, I wanted to ask one question. Is the U.S. getting less involved in world affairs? Like the withdrawal from Saudi Arabia, we withdrew since we have a base in Iraq. Then we are trying to withdraw from Germany since we are no longer involved in Eastern Europe as the countries join the EU. Would it be a factor that we are trying to withdraw from South Korea and try and base our military in Afghanistan?
So, well, Tom Donnelly, how do you characterize all these changes? They're different. Are they less or more?
Well, I think they're more. And by repositioning, it's like stretching a rubber band. We stretch it tighter and tighter as we sort of take on more missions. We assume these missions, say, in the Balkans, and they don't take a long time to get through them. It's not the fighting part so much. It's the sort of political reconstruction. We see in Afghanistan, that's going to be a long running mission, the number of forces there has increased actually since the combat portion or the main combat portion is over, and the same is true in Iraq. So we're moving the pieces about in hopes of lessening the tension on the rubber band, but when you sort of look at the global picture, we're doing more with less.
Hmm. Justin, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, I have one more quick question.
If you make it very quick, please.
Okay, about North Korea, how come they've been claiming to have nuclear weapons for the last 6 years or 8 years? Are we not finally tired of giving them compromises so we no longer take them as a threat?
Tom Donnelly?
Well, we're still really worried about North Korea. As was discussed earlier, we're worried conventionally, but the question of North Korean nuclear questions is a constant worry. And I think sort of in an intelligence way, we sort of assess that they've already got a small number of them. So somehow or other, we're going to have to learn to deal with it and to live with it, I suppose.
Time for one more quick call. Marty joins us on the line from St. Augustine, Florida.
Yeah, pleasure to call you again. I love your program.
Thank you.
Regarding deployment and redeployment of troops, I think that we may be playing a na-na-na-na-na game because as far as the goal, my idea of deploying or redeploying military is like a chess game. It's to put our forces strategically in positions that benefit our military. I read recently that South Korea, if we pull the forces away from the DMZ, that there are villages that are set up to service the GIs and their economy is going to be hurt. I say to hell with them. The military is here to protect the American interests, and that should be our primary concern. I think we're in Bosnia still. We have no reason being there. There is no reason to be in that place. As far as pulling out of Saudi Arabia, long overdue. And as far as even the idea of stationing forces on the ground, as has been shown by our lightning victory in Iraq, aircraft carrier battle groups and airborne assaults and air cavalry units, I think, make deployments on the ground almost obsolete. Now, I'm a student of war.
Got to wrap it up, Marty.
Okay, I just think that it's not being done right by whatever president, and it just has to be reevaluated.
Okay, well, we only have about 30 seconds left, Tom Donnelly. Why don't you address the Bosnia question? That's not one we've talked about.
Well, look, I would say we have a pretty good reason to be there in that the process of fixing Bosnia politically is still a long way from being complete. There are war criminals who are still on the loose. And as in Bosnia, in many ways, so in the rest of the world. The picture is even more so true in Afghanistan. And our goal in Iraq, our stated goal that President Bush has committed not just his administration but the entire country to, is really a long-term process. And we ought to make it easier on the people who do service for us.
Tom Donnelly, thanks as always for coming in.
My pleasure.
Tom Donnelly is a defense policy analyst with the American Enterprise Institute. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Coming up after the break, sports writer John Feinstein and the story of a legendary golf course, Bethpage Black. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.